Hello and welcome to the American Magazine podcast for the week of September 12th. This is our religious education issue, so we brought in somebody involved in religious education who also has an article in the current issue, Brian Pinter. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Tim. Happy to be here.
Now, Brian has an article in the current issue, which is about the question of biblical fundamentalism. I should mention that Brian is the director of campus ministry at Regis High School here in New York, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. But first, let's talk about your article. Brian, you begin with kind of an intriguing anecdote about some classes you were given in Bible study. Maybe you can recount that for our listeners.
Well, I was leading a Bible study at a Catholic parish, and the subject matter was Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And we read the text very carefully, and when we moved to interpretation, I approached it in the Catholic method, which is the contextual approach where we consider historical context and cultural context and the literary context of the passage. I used the term foundation myth. I said these stories are foundation myths, and this was very common in ancient Near Eastern cultures. When we say myth, a lot of people misunderstand. They think it's, well, that's something that was once thought to be true, but we know it's not true. And I said, no, a myth in this context is a story that uses symbolic characters and events to speak to larger realities and larger truths. And let's take a look at the text and see what those larger truths that the authors were trying to get at. And there were a few people in the class, not many, but there were a few, who really had a problem with this, and they could not go beyond seeing the story as anything other than history. That in fact, this is the story, an eyewitness account of how God created the world in 6 days, and there was a talking serpent, and Adam and Eve, and all this literally happened, and you're saying it's not true. If you're saying if it's not historically true, then it's not true. And I tried to explain how these stories have deeper theological meanings and implications, but they were very upset by this. And it actually became a distraction because classes spent a lot of time, we spent a lot of time sort of dealing with these problems that these people were having. And I thought to myself, this is a real issue because the Catholic Church does not take the literalist approach. It's discouraged, officially speaking. And I found my experience was not unique there. I had led some Bible study sessions at other parishes, and I encountered similar things. I remember, for example, I led one on the infancy narratives of Matthew and Luke during Advent 1 year. And there were a few people who struggled with the idea that there could be more going on in those texts than just a historical recounting of what happened, you know, that there are larger theological truths that the authors are trying to convey through characters and events.
Yeah, you mentioned here a statistic from Gallup where 21% of U.S. Catholics identify themselves as biblical literalists. You also mentioned that the church has been very critical of biblical literalism, and I was struck by this quote in your piece, which describes fundamentalism as intellectual suicide. So they're not mincing words here.
Yeah, they actually said that. That's in the in 1993, the Pontifical Biblical Commission issued a document called The Interpretation of the Bible in the Church. They go over various methods of interpretation, historical, critical, feminist, liberation, sociocultural, and they critique them all, and they point out the good things and the potential limitations. And they do treat fundamentalism, biblical fundamentalism, and they basically say no, this is not acceptable, and it's problematic in many ways. It instills a false sense of certitude about the meaning of biblical passages, and they say it invites people to a sort of intellectual suicide.
Now, you've had some time to think about this. Why do you think that biblical literalism is attractive to them?
I think there's a variety of reasons. First, I think that some people, they have easy access to literalist preaching. They can just spin the radio dial in most parts of the country, and you'll pick it up somewhere. It's all over the internet. You can certainly find it there. I think that some people are just looking for Bible study, and if their parish is not offering it, And the only church in the area that is offering organized Bible classes is the Foursquare Tabernacle down the road. People will go there. They're interested in the Bible. They want to know. It's appealing. It's fascinating. And they'll take whatever they can get. And if the literalist interpretation is the only thing that's being offered, then they'll fall under that influence. I think also it's the default American interpretation. Biblical literalism was invented here. It developed in America, and anywhere you find it in the world, it's because Americans have exported it. It was defined at the turn of the 20th century as a reaction to liberal Protestant exegesis. There were some very conservative reactionary Protestants who thought that the only way we can preserve the integrity of the Christian faith is if we insist upon a literal interpretation of the Bible. And so I think that, we see this all over the place. It's in our political discourse and how people interpret Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And in the article I mentioned, there was a gubernatorial candidate in Alabama who was criticized by his opponents because he said not all the Bible is meant to be interpreted literally. It's almost like it's a test of your religiosity. How do you read the Bible? And I think that for those people who don't have any background, any education in how to read the Bible and interpret it, they default to that because they want to defend the truth of Scripture. They want to say the Bible is true. And the only way they know how to express that is by saying, well, it's literally true. I mean, we know that there are other ways of expressing truth, but they say, no, it must be historically accurate for it to be true.
Right. You write in your article that there's this tendency to look at the Bible as kind of a user's manual or a playbook. What's wrong with that? I mean, what's wrong with kind of just looking to the Bible as, just the text itself for guidance?
Well, if it's a user's manual or a playbook or a rule book, it's not a very good one. It could have used a better author and editors, because there's a lot of things it leaves unsaid. There are questions we have that could use really direct rule-like answers that aren't there. And there's a lot of extraneous material that doesn't seem to apply, that's rule-like or user's manual-like. As far as the owner's manual analogy goes, this summer I renovated my kitchen and I installed a new dishwasher, and it came with an owner's manual. And it had all the information I needed to set the thing up and use it properly, and it had troubleshooting. And it also had diagrams and illustrations. And good owner's manuals have those things. There's a great New Testament scholar up at Yale. His name is Dale Martin. He's a New Testament heavyweight. And he said, good owner's manuals have diagrams and illustrations, and that would be especially helpful in our arguments about sexuality. if we could see, oh, tab A goes into slot B, and that would answer a lot of questions. So in that sense, it seems to be an incomplete rule book or owner's manual. And it can lead to problems. Another popular designation sort of in that family is the Bible's a blueprint. Well, you know who reads the Bible as a blueprint? It's the Old Order Amish out there in Pennsylvania and upstate New York and Ohio. And I have some experience with them. I worked on a farm in Lancaster several years ago. And they set up their church just as the New Testament says. The New Testament talks about them meeting. The early Christians met in their homes, so the Amish meet in their homes. They sing in church a cappella, because the New Testament does not mention anything about musical instruments. And they don't have any worship aids or printed materials, because the New Testament doesn't mention that. And they don't have Sunday school, because that's not mentioned in the New Testament. So they use it very much like a blueprint. But then when questions arise, there are some groups who thought, well, maybe we should have Sunday school. Maybe we should have church bulletins and worship aids and things like that. And then they can't agree because the New Testament doesn't answer that question. There's nothing to say about that. And it becomes divisive. So when I found that one locks oneself into a very strict view, conception of what the Bible is, that probably creates more questions than it answers and leads to more problems than it solves.
Well, let's look at the Catholic Church's approach to reading the Bible. What does the approach of historical biblical scholarship, you know, kind of looking at the many layers and the many, you know, the many voices that contributed to this as a text. What does that add to the reading experience?
Well, the Catholic approach insists upon understanding the context. What is the historical context in which the book was written? What is the literary context of a particular passage in the larger book or in the Bible? I have found that that is tremendously enriching, because when we are aware of context, we see that the larger questions, the larger truths that the sacred authors were grappling with still speak to people today. You know, for example, when I teach the book of Job to my high school students, the larger existential question behind that, when we look at the context, when we ask why was this book written, it's because somebody was saying, you know, the old theology that the good is always rewarded and evil is punished doesn't always seem to be the case. And why do bad things happen to good people? And so to answer that question, or to deal with that question, somebody wrote this drama of the book of Job. And you know, that's a question, that's an existential question that people are still asking today. And when you put it in that context, when we can say our ancestors in faith were asking the same questions, they had the same struggles, and they were inspired to write this, that can be tremendously enriching, and it connects us with the universal church, past and present, and our ancestors in Israelite religion, in a way that I think the strict literalist interpretation does not, because it doesn't account for context.
Now, this is a good segue to talk about your work at Regis High School, which is an all-boys Jesuit high school here in New York. You're the director of campus ministry. What is your experience with working with young people in terms of the Bible? Like, do you encounter some of these same issues over, you know, the questions of biblical literalism, or are there ways, strategies you employ to kind of get them interested in this text?
No, I find that the biblical literalism among my students, it's really not an issue. Most of them have had pretty good religious training and through their grammar school years, and then at Regis, they're required to take religion classes every year. So they have a really sound, solid background. Oftentimes they ask me, well, when we encounter biblical fundamentalists, how do we answer them? What should we do? You know, that's where that's where it comes up. I always tell them, I say, well, don't argue with them. You know, you cannot win. So don't start trading Bible passages with them. To get them interested, I like to introduce the context to them. Especially, I find they're very fascinated by the cultural context out of which these books emerged. Especially when we're dealing with Jesus. I teach a class to seniors on Jesus, and they're just fascinated by Jesus as a man existing in Middle Eastern culture 2,000 years ago, practicing Israelite religion and everything that meant. And I think they feel like they're really relating to human characters, and they see the biblical characters, they see Jesus as three-dimensional in that way. Just as an example, in the first class I have each semester, each year when I teach this course on Jesus, after we do the preliminary stuff, I just give them some teasers about what Middle Eastern culture, what that meant, and how you can see that coming through in gospel passages. And then we talk about the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father, and we compare the two versions in Matthew and Luke, and we see what they share in common. And when we distill that, we get that what we think is a very primitive version of the Our Father, which is actually what Luke's version is. I tell them, you know, if you translate this into Aramaic, it rhymes. And then I read it for them in Aramaic, and I say, this is most likely what Jesus said, and it was really useful for his audience because literacy was low. And by giving them something that rhymes, it would be easily remembered. And you can see their faces light up. They say, wow. Because then they really feel like they're looking, they're face to face with Jesus there. They're hearing his voice and his language in the historical and cultural contexts that he would have been living in. And I think they find it, when they can see the man, when they can see the real person, they find that's someone they can relate to, that's someone that they want to listen to. And it can be very helpful for them in their faith development.
I mentioned this is our religious education issue, and I find, you know, I've worked here for several years and at Catholic publications for several years, the question of the faith of young Catholics and passing on the faith is something that Catholics are of our generation, but older generations as well, are very interested in it because they want to see the faith passed on and preserved. You've been at Regis now, you know, running retreats as the director of campus ministry, working with students for 5 years, you said. What is your experience? I mean, are you optimistic about, you know, the future of the church given your work with these young people?
I am. I find them to be very motivated and very interested and dedicated to their faith. I mean, having said that, they are high school students, and that's a time of transition, and they're asking questions, and they're going from the faith of a child to the faith of an adult. And so they're trying to figure out why they believe what they were taught, what they were raised to believe, what they say they believe. And they're beginning to think critically about religious ideas. And they're going through the struggle of making their faith truly their own, which I think is a necessary struggle that everyone has to go through to come to a sense of mature faith. But I have found that whether it's in the classroom or in a setting of retreats or the service work that they do, they can be very strongly committed to gospel values. And they might articulate that in a different way than the official church does. And they might be seeking a slightly different experience of church. But I find those basic gospel values, what it means to be a disciple of Jesus, working for peace and justice, that vision of a time of physical and spiritual wholeness, of inclusion, reconciliation, forgiveness, compassion, all those things that were really at the heart of Jesus's ministry and Jesus's vision for the kingdom of God, that really appeals to them. They're into that. They find that inspiring. And as I said, they might use different terms to express that, but they can be very committed to that.
Well, that's good to hear. I guess the question always is, you know, in high school where you have it, Catholic high school is kind of an intensive, you know, retreats and opportunities for people to do some faith formation and faith sharing. And then again, if you go to Catholic colleges, there's a good liturgy experience. It seems that the difficult point is like when you graduate and finding a place after that. I mean, have you kept in touch with some of your students and how they continue to try to grow in the faith and find a place, you know, outside of school?
I have, and that's a struggle. And as we know, there's when they become young adults, sometimes there's a little bit of drift that goes on, and there's parish shopping, for lack of a better term, and they're trying to find their place, and they're trying to find experiences that might have enlivened them the way, say, what they saw in college or in high school did. So that remains a challenge, engaging them as they become young adults. And young adults are struggling with their own set of questions, with identity and vocation and that sort of thing. And I think that they naturally want to look to the church for wisdom in that way. And those of us active in church life have to find a way to take the best of our tradition and present it to them in a way that's going to be appealing and that speaks to their experience. And that really meets them where they are. That's clearly one of the big challenges in youth and young adult ministry as I see it today. I think there are things that those of us active in church life can do to make the church continue to make the church appealing. Catholicism has a lot going for it when it comes to these big questions that young people are asking. I think we need to be careful about some of the things that we do. Our internal culture sometimes can be not very nice. You know, it can be vitriolic and it can be uncharitable. You know, if you just take a look at the Catholic blogosphere, it's not always a nice place. And as we know, young people look to the internet and that sort of thing for a lot of their information. And we just have to be aware of that if we are disciples of Jesus and we're going to live by his example and his values, then we have to really reflect that. And that has to really permeate our internal culture, as well as what we project to the world.
Well, on that note, I think that's a good note to end on, and one that I hope some of our blog correspondents will heed. But Brian Pinter from Regis High School, we want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tim.